Okay, we'll call to order the House Revenue Committee. Welcome, everybody. I apologize for the late start. Floor went late, and so we are, this is our 1:15 start, which really is pretty close to being on time. It feels like end of session coming on, everybody, so let's go to that quiet place now.
This was the Calhoun Day.
Counting you on there?
End of session. I'm saying it feels like end of session.
I thought you knew something, Mr. Chair, that I could take home.
Well, you know. I gotta have some outlet for my artistic.
I'm in that proverbial state of I know nothing.
Yeah.
Senator Carno, why don't you join us? Let's begin with a public hearing on HJR 45 and invite Senator Bev Carno to join us today. Okay. So are we, but we're staying.
Yes. I'm here to introduce the folks from my district, and I am absent from the Trade and Economic Development Committee, so if you have any messages you want me to take back, you should let me know. I appreciate you letting us hear this bill, and I'm here to introduce the folks from my district because the bill that you have before you will resolve a huge problem and a huge concern. I don't know if I said or not that I am, for the record, Bev Carno, Senator from Senate District 27, which is Central Oregon. And on my right here, I have Dennis Luke, County Commissioner for Deschutes County, former state legislator, and also a very dear friend of mine. And next to him is someone I've worked with in our community on many programs for children and families, and as well as public safety issues, the Chief of Police in Bend, Andy Jordan. And behind me, who is going to take my seat, our new sheriff, who's doing a wonderful job in Sherman County, Sheriff Les Stiles, who's going to talk to you about the concern and the need we have with House Joint Resolution 45. With that, I thank you very much for letting us be here.
Thank you, Senator. Good to see you. Let's take just 30 seconds, and or however long it takes, and ask Elizabeth to give us the staff summary, and then we'll invite testimony from our witnesses.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Joint Resolution 45, amending the Oregon Constitution to allow a local taxing district to divide its district into tax zones and then establish a permanent tax rate for each zone if the majority of the voters in the taxing district approve the measure. So this would require a statewide vote, and then also local voters would decide on the amount that they would have for the permanent rate for each of the tax zones. Now, basically, we have heard, and we will get into that too when we go through the statutorial House Bill 3458 measure, but we've seen tax zones established for special districts. That was one that we had on Monday. And basically, under current law, local taxing districts have a permanent tax rate. They're established with Measure 50 and 97, but it has to be uniformly applied to all taxpayers in their district. And by statute, you can have tax zones that can be created, but each one of these property tax rate is limited then by the local district's permanent tax rate in Measure 50. So this constitutional amendment now is going to be allowing local voters to approve tax rates in those tax zones that could exceed their permanent tax rate if they so chose under Measure 50. These new locally approved tax rates in the zones would still be subject to the Measure 5 tax limit. And under current law, which I'm sure the testimony will attest to, that Deschutes County has a split sheriff's local option tax rate, one for rural and another for the urban taxpayers. And this would allow them then to have that permanent rate split, similar to how they're doing with their local option currently. So as far as the revenue impact, it is uncertain. It's going to depend on whether or not HJR 45 receives statewide voter approval as well as local voter approval of tax zones. And also one point of clarification with HJR 45 is I think the assumption that's made here is that these tax zones will only be allowed and established by local districts that have never imposed property taxes before. And then that would reduce the number of districts statewide that would be allowed to establish a tax zone.
Okay. Mr. Dennis, welcome back. And for
thank
those
you.
Members who, let me see, I think Representative Beck is the only one on this committee that served with you and me in 97. So, scary thing about term limits, but welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you very much. My name is Dennis Luke, Deschutes County Commissioner. Thank you for hearing the bill today. We're passing out a legislative council opinion, Department of Revenue letter, and then that the Department of Revenue had their AG do an opinion, which you have, and then a letter from Deschutes County asking why we needed the letter from the Attorney General. Deschutes County was one of the one of two counties. Lynn County was the other one that happened to have their levy up for a vote the same time, same election Measure 50 passed, which created all kinds of problems for us. We have been in the sheriff has been on a levy all the way through. We've never had a taxing district for the sheriff. We were ready to go for a taxing district this last November, but it came out that from the AG's opinion, the legislative council opinion, that we couldn't do that. And so we put that on hold, and then coming to the legislature to ask permission to send the bill out allowing local jurisdictions, and there are some other counties and cities that are interested, to go out for a split rate district. How this works in Deschutes County is that the cities, the incorporated cities, Sun River and Black Butte, pay 78 cents per thousand. And that covers the cost of the sheriff's jails for parole, probation, and the court costs for transporting prisoners and those kind of things. That's charged countywide. Then additionally, the difference between 78 cents and $1.12 is paid by county residents for patrols. So the county residents pay $1.12, city residents pay 78 cents, and it seems to work out fairly well. And I'm just here to introduce Sheriff Stiles, who will talk about how this affects his department and why he'd like to see this.
Welcome, Sheriff.
Chairman Shetterly, members of the commission, thank you for your time this afternoon. I'm here, I was elected the sheriff November 7th of last year, so I walked in and was sworn in on January 2nd. However, for the last 17 years, I was a member of the Bend City Police Department, and I've watched with a great deal of chagrin the number of employees that we have been able to snag over from the sheriff's office to the city of Bend. The bottom line in all of this has to do with funding, mechanisms for funding, and the impact on that, not only to the organizations, but to the taxpayers themselves. The first and foremost issue that I'm concerned about with respect to this proposed legislation is that it is the only one that allows for a fair and equitable way to assess costs for services being provided. In other words, it's not fair for city residents to pay for services that they're already paying for in another way. I think that Chief Jordan will address that issue a little bit more here in just a minute. But the real impact for me, since January 2nd, I've been involved in at least three projects so far, one of which involves our 911 center and the chief of police for the city of Bend, in looking at regional concepts, regional 911, regional records, regional software, ways in which we can work together better to serve the public better at a cheaper cost. The bottom line is that no matter what kind of commitment I make, I can't follow through on it because I can't forecast more than 3 years in advance under an operating levy. So any commitment that I would make toward any of these kinds of moves that we need to make in a progressive manner, I can't even commit to funding beyond 3 years. More importantly, as far as I'm concerned, all of the decisions that I make with short-term vision have long-term impact, and it's a really inefficient use of our tax dollars. I'll go back now for just 1 second and address the high turnover rate. We have a retention problem at the sheriff's office right now, and it hasn't gone away, and it isn't going to go away until this problem is fixed. We're investing $100,000 tax dollars every time I hire somebody, swear them in, and bring them in as a deputy to train them, get them up to speed and out on the road and equip them. And then my counterpart at the end of the table, with no signing bonus whatsoever, takes them away. So we start all over again. The biggest reason for this turnover has to do with lack of stable funding, because most people don't want to take a job where they're not going to be able to feed their kids, or may not be able to, because they're going to be laid off at the end of a 3-year operating levy. And we're facing that right now today. March 13th, we went to the voters and proposed our 3-year operating levy. It passed by a margin of 3-1. For the first time ever in Deschutes County, we carried 100% of the precincts, more yes than no, and it failed simply because of lack of 50% of voter turnout. Now, that may not address, that's not addressed by your bill. The fact of the matter is that I've got 225 employees right now, many of whom are looking at whether or not they're going to be there when we go to the voters again this May. And we go May 15th, the ballots are mailed this Friday, and the fact of the matter is I've got people with job apps out right now. So that's a real serious problem. And the last thing I wanted to address real quickly is the lack of continuity for program staff in the community. This is just an inefficient way to run government. It needs to be run better, and it can't be without the enabling legislation. So with that, what I would like to do, if you don't mind, is introduce Chief of Police Andy Jordan from the City of Bend.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm pleased to be here this afternoon. Les Stiles has kind of laid it out pretty clearly, I think, of what some of the issues are. As a representative of a municipal organization, we think that this kind of funding is the best way to serve our local taxpayers. It is very unfair for a City of Bend resident to pay not only the full amount to the county for county services, and then pay also additional city tax to fund their police department, and then only get partial services from the county sheriff's office. So this particular bill, if it should go through, will allow us to, number one, set a permanent tax district, and then collect fees that are fair for city taxpayers. We realize that it's very important for the sheriff to conduct those state-mandated services, such as the operation of the county jail, service of summons and other court services, and then the operation of the courts themselves that are not state run. These kinds of services are very important to our community, and we're very concerned about losing the ability to fairly look at those services. The taxpayers in the City of Bend and also the City of Redmond and those other taxing districts, which will be funded at a lower taxing rate, all have their own police departments and public safety agencies, and this will allow them to, and us in the City of Bend, to continue to provide our level of service and also enable us to fairly tax our citizens and get those state-mandated services from the sheriff. It's a matter of fairness, and it's a matter of good public policy to look at taxing this way. I don't think the intention of Measure 50 back a few years ago was to put us in this position. I think it was overlooked in the writing of that bill, and this is just a way to clean up some of that language and make this a fair approach to taxing.
I'd like to point out there were some county, there were some jurisdictions that were grandfathered in under Measure 50 and are allowed to do this. In preparation for going out last November, we had to get the cities to okay the taxing district, and so we brought an accounting firm over from Eugene who actually did a study of whether the breakdown between the 78 cents and $1.12 and for the services, not whether you're paying for the full service, but whether the percentages were right. The accounting firm came back with a positive that was the percentages were right, the breakdown was good, and if we were able to go out statewide on this, both the sheriff and the chief of police and I as a commissioner will be working on partnerships with other counties and jurisdictions, sheriff's association, police chief's association, put together partnerships to pass this statewide.
Questions for this panel? Representative Hess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, since you mentioned it, how would you feel if we amended this and passed it out that included a repeal of the supermajority clause?
it was a very interesting election. There were several contested seats on there, some that had four candidates. Some of the undervote in those elections ran from 19%, which was low, to up to 35 to 38% at the high. Sheriffs had less than 2% undervote on his levy. I believe the double majority probably is unconstitutional. I don't know of any jurisdiction that's ready to go out and challenge that. But the double majority allows a person to have a no vote by staying home, and I don't see how that could be constitutional.
Representative, could I add just a quick word here? I believe that under Article 11, Section 11, Sub 8 of the Oregon Constitution, that in fact the double majority is unconstitutional, and I suspect you'll get a great deal of support from Deschutes County. I've talked to numerous voters who have all told me their frustration with having to go back yet again now in May on an issue that was overwhelmingly passed, and it failed because of that supermajority requirement. There's a great deal of frustration out there, and I suspect if something isn't done legislatively, that I know of at least one organization that has contemplated a suit over the issue.
Well, Sheriff, actually, we agree, but you get a lot of support out of Deschutes County, but there are 35 other counties that would have to vote on this.
Yes, sir. Yes,
and,
sir.
I'm thinking last November you had another technical little fix that I don't think should have amounted to much of anything to anybody, and
We ended up opposing that, Mr. Chair, because the numbers that...
You did. You wrote all the Oregonians.
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, the reason is that because the numbers came out differently after the governor had signed the bill than they were before the governor signed the bill. And so we felt that it had unintended consequences, Mr. Chair.
Like Mr. let me ask, does this fix the Linn County problem, too? I'm assuming it does.
Mr. Chair, this has nothing to do with that fix from before.
Okay, right.
This simply allows, is permissive language that allows a jurisdiction to go out and do a split rate.
So this could be applied statewide, for that matter.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There has been some interest and calls from other counties who talked about this. I think the sheriff has talked to different sheriffs in different counties who would be interested in this. This would be you look at Washington County, which is set up a lot like Deschutes County, where you have a couple big cities, and then the rest, a lot of it's rural. This would work in Washington County also.
So I guess I want to get this is not a targeted fix like last time.
No, sir.
Addressing just the Linn and Deschutes County. Yeah. Representative Bates, you had a question.
I just want to make sure I understand this carefully before we vote on it. What you're asking to do is...
You will.
It's questionable. life does take some interesting twists and turns. You know, I have a running feud with the Sheriff's Department in Deschutes County over my boat, which has black lettering on a blue background. They're always coming after me for that one, you know.
There are a number of changes.
This is unseemly.
Actually, I looked it up, and the guy was right.
Actually, there are a number of changes
fantastic
coming.
Colors. So, anyway, he was very polite about it, but quite insistent. And I had to appear in court and everything. Terrible.
your question.
Confession's good for the soul, Representative.
Basically, what you're saying is you want to get first a permit tax, so you don't have to go back to levy each time. And once you get it in place, we've gone to the tax limits of ballot measure 50, which is that 3% rise, I assume that's what we're talking about. So it seems kind of contradictory what's written here in the explanation. So it comes in, you get a permit tax base, and it's for the county but not for the cities. And once you get in place, if you do get in place by both the people, it can only rise by 3% on your assessed valuation. Is that right, Elizabeth?
Mr. Chair, could I do that a second? Is that right? Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, you would have two rates of 78 cents in the cities and $1.12 in the county. So you got two of them there. Deschutes County has been very fortunate that we not only get the 3% because of houses have increasing that quickly over there, but we also get the new growth. And the previous sheriff and this sheriff believe they can live with that rate unless you add in the growth. And we also backfill them with room tax money because of the amount of tourists that we get. You need the patrols on the road. We back them. The levy is about 50% of your budget, about 50%.
Yeah.
We believe we can live in it. with the 3% increase.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to be sure I understood the bill. What you want to do?
Mr. Chair, I would, Representative Haas, we had a voter turnout of 45%. If the other 5% had all voted no, we still would have passed the levy.
2-1.
2-1.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Anybody else for this panel? Did you want to testify on 3458, too? That's another one from Representative Canope. I wasn't sure whether he brought you over for that. Okay, that's fine. Okay. Anything else from this panel? All right, thank you very much.
Need any other information, your staff will get a hold of it.
Okay, thanks. I want to spend some time taking a look at the background. I appreciate the background materials you gave us with these letters, Legislative Council and Department of Justice and Department of Revenue. Anybody else wish to testify? That's all I have signed up on this bill, this resolution. Anybody else? Okay, with that, I'll close the public hearing on HJR 45. Let's go ahead to $3,700. Who's staffing that? $3,700?
Well,
I guess, yeah, but okay, question, before, is anybody here to sign up to testify on 34? I know, anybody here signed up to testify on
3458? Yeah, John.
John Phillips? Okay, then I say, well, I apologize. In that case, let's do 3458 before we go to 3700, as long as we're staying in the same theme, but when those folks indicated they weren't going to be testifying, I thought we might not have anyone. Okay, let me do that then. Sorry, we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 3458, since that relates to the same subject matter as HJR 45. And Elizabeth? Okay. And Dick, Elizabeth, why don't you go ahead and...
So with House Bill 3458, this is implementing language. It can stand alone, though. It is not... dependent on HJR 45 passing. So just what this is doing is very similar to your bill you had on Monday, the House Bill 2869 with special districts, the road districts. But now we're going to be allowing these county service districts to establish those tax zones. If the local voters approve the zones, then you have the different tax rates in each one of the zones, and the tax zones have to be based on a qualitative difference in the service that is provided to the taxpayers in each zone. Again, it outlines the requirements of the notice of the public hearing, and then it requires those governing bodies which decide to establish a tax zone to submit to voters a measure establishing the zones, the boundaries, and the permanent tax rate that will be applied in each zone, and then the majority of the voters in the district has to approve the tax zone. So I think the important thing to realize here is that, you know, under current law, counties can establish these service zones for any particular single service like law enforcement. The local voters go out and they have to approve a permanent tax rate for that new service district. But that permanent tax rate for the new district is uniformly, again, applied to all taxpayers in the district. That's why this does not meet Deschutes County's needs, is that they want this permanent rate to be split between different taxpayers, the urban versus the rural. What you have is that with Deschutes County, this is their preference, is to establish a county service district for law enforcement, and then a district that has not previously imposed those property taxes, they're going to go to their voters and seek a permanent tax rate for the service district, and then with these tax zones, they can establish different permanent rates, and that's how this fits in with HJR 45. Again, the amount of the impact is really going to depend on how much interest there is in being able to establish tax zones for county service districts. There would be a reduction in local revenue because basically these county service districts are limited by their permanent tax rate that is established by the voters.
Okay, thank you. John Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue.
Yes, this bill would be different than HGR 45. HGR 45 would deal with any new district or any district that hadn't net levied before. This bill deals with narrowly county service districts, but for any district that would want to establish zones. The issue on Monday's hearing, Monday's bill 2869 was amended because whenever boundaries are changed or boundaries are established, the assessor needs to know where those boundaries are on a tax lot by tax lot basis so that they know who to tax what. And so the amendment that you put into 2869 would be the same amendment I would suggest for this bill, which is simply triggers a notice to the county assessor with a filing of a map and a legal boundary description, and they can change their records.
That's the amendment you're referring to, not the one that limited it to counties with populations between 100 and 200,000 and square mileage of 35,000. And
you're correct.
Okay.
Good.
Have you talked with Representative Knope about this by any chance?
I mentioned it to other people that were working with the bill on Monday.
Okay.
And I didn't speak to him directly, no.
All right, very good. We'll
they
take
were
a look
fine
at that. Thank you. Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 3458 before I close the public hearing on that? Okay. Now we will go to public hearing on House Bill 3700 and invite Dick to join us.
Good Chair.
Good afternoon.
Members of the Committee, Dick Yates with Legislative Revenue. House Bill 3700 deals with the lottery and the appropriation or allocation of $8 million in lottery revenues to Oregon Public Broadcasting. You have an amendment for this bill, the dash one, which divides that so that $7 million goes essentially to Oregon Public
Broadcasting. Wait, dash one. We don't have dash one.
I have dash one.
I heard about them, but we don't have them.
And I've heard about them, too. Yeah.
Anybody see the dash ones over there?
It's for radio.
We can get copies.
Please. Here's a
Here's
a copy floating around.
You get it too.
Representative Westland, what have you joined us for?
We can trade some goats.
The bench, you may. We're in 3700. You care about that?
Am I interested in 3700?
No. Yeah.
Well, I'm interested in all your work.
Oh, I'm sure you are. It's good work.
You know what? It wasn't specifically.
What bill do you want?
Ain't gonna happen.
You want 3700?
Well, PB.
Okay. All right.
Left hand.
Oh, gee. Right hand. Look at that, Westland.
Your timing is impeccable.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the reason you confused me, we just had a couple of Deschutes County bills, and I thought you might have some interest in those, but maybe not.
Pilot County.
Pilot County.
Deschutes County has some unusual needs, and they were going to raise the county wide assessment of people living in Tumalo by a factor of 10.
And those living in Tumalo as well.
And those with vacation homes in Sun River.
Now, before we get too far afield, let's have Dick finish the staff summary, and then we'll...
That's basically what the bill in its original form allocates the $8 million to Oregon Public Broadcasting from the Economic Administrative Services Economic Development Fund. The rest of the language in the bill there simply recognizes that this money is available only if there's sufficient lottery revenue to meet the other commitments. And as I said, the Dashman amendments were Paul has arranged to have those copied for you. I'm sorry that I didn't have them. Simply says that the $8 million is divided with $7 million going to Oregon Public Broadcasting and $1 million going to Southern Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Now, Representative Westland, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Representative Ben Westland, District 55, Central Oregon, here to testify on behalf of Oregon Public Broadcasting's revenue request for this session. As probably most of you know, or perhaps some of you don't know, Oregon Public Broadcasting has been in existence in Oregon for over 75 years. It's grown into a statewide network of 5 television stations, 4 radio stations, and 56 radio and television translators, reaching approximately 95% of Oregon's population. More than 1.5 million people use OPB's television programming each week. And also, Oregon Public Broadcasting is proud to provide access to more than 500,000 school children and 30,000 school teachers. Oregon Public Broadcasting is now faced with a somewhat of a crisis brought on by the benefits of technology and mandates from the federal government. They have functionally got to cross the digital divide, and that costs money. It's one of those things where we have an opportunity. I believe the request is right at $8.1 million. That would be a 3-to-1 match that we'll get from private donors and federal funds. Needless to say, I believe this is a wise use of public funding. It's a judicious use of public funding given the match, and it enhances not only the quality of life for many Oregonians, but also the educational opportunities provided to Oregonians across the state. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions for Representative Westland. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, in view of the fact that there's in excess of 100 commercial stations available on most cable networks with a wide variety of subject matter, why, in your opinion, is it worthwhile to provide public monies to Oregon Public Broadcasting?
Thank you for the question, Representative. In many of the urban areas, I would not dispute your numbers. I'm not familiar with them. I take them at face value, but in most of our rural areas, they're nowhere near such television opportunities available. That's one of the reasons I think this is prudent use of public funds. The other would be the quality of programming and the educational content consistency of programming available, even in urban areas. I think OPB delivers a consistently high, broad-based, diverse level of programming that challenges one's mind as well as the imagination.
Anybody else? All right, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Let me bring up then Bill Swindells, Tony Van Vliet, and Bill Campbell. Now, committee, excuse us while Mr. Swindells and I digress on growing up in Dallas.
That would be a digression, Mr. Mayor.
Not an oxymoron.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, members of the committee. I am Bill Swindells, Chair of Oregon Public Broadcasting. Joining me today is Bill Campbell with Southern Oregon Public Television, and Tony Van Vliet, who is also an Oregon Public Broadcasting chair, board member, and my legislative guiding light. I wanted to simply hit some of the high points of the written text that you've had provided to you, and that job was done very well by Representative Westland. I would be repeating many of them. What I want to do is I'm going to respond briefly to Representative Witt's question from the board's position, and then also talk a little bit more about the FCC mandate. And we have, after these two other gentlemen give some testimony, we have a brief sample of what digital broadcasting will provide. The key component of public broadcasting, in my mind, is that it is non-commercial. While there is a vast array of commercial broadcasting, the motivation behind that is to sell commercials. Public broadcasting is content-driven, with the content being in the interest of the viewer or listener first. Children's broadcasting is the most glaring example of that, but we feel it serves listeners and viewers of all ages. To clarify further the FCC mandate, Federal Communications Commission has charged all broadcasters to go to a digital format. The former format is over 50 years old. Bringing television to digital transmission is really kind of bringing it up to where everything else has arrived. It's not a matter of leading or coming up with a new technology that may be replaced later. It is an economic and scientifically practical solution, and we support it. Because of the configuration of the state of Oregon and its two principal public television broadcasters, we have a huge infrastructure challenge. Combined, we have 6 transmitters and 52 translators that must be replaced. The extreme other example is for WGBH Boston can replace one transmitter and serve 5 million people with that one investment. We have a much larger one. I'd like to, before questions, let Mr. Campbell and Mr. Van Vliet also give some testimony.
All right. Mr. Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bill Campbell. I'm president and CEO of Southern Oregon Public Television. Our coverage area is basically the southwest quadrant of Oregon. Our transmitters are on the Josephine, Douglas County line and in Klamath County. As Mr. Swindell gave you a great elaboration on Oregon Public Broadcasting, we also have some of the similar missions and visions of, for Southern Oregon Public Television. We are providing public television to the state of Oregon, but we also work together and share our resources and our programs. Southern Oregon Public Television has an additional mission, and that is to provide local programs and non-broadcast program-related services to the viewers of Southern Oregon. We have strong partnerships with educational institutions, and our vision is to increase these partnerships and the services through the new digital channels that we will have when the conversion is complete. Your appropriation of $1 million will give a large financial boost to an organization with a limited number of potential corporate donors and the population in Southern Oregon. As Southern Oregon Public Television did in 1995 and 96, we will leverage those state funds leading towards a successful capital campaign and our digital conversion. Again, thank you for the opportunity to be here today and for considering our request.
Good to see you back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have to quit meeting like this.
Yeah. There's no bat to evaluate your testimony today, though. No Batman.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here and wearing a hat of OPB. If you remember, when I closed my comment last time we were together about taxation, I did have a mention about lottery funds. And lottery funds in their original intent were to be used in the way of economic development and for capital expenditures. It's my belief that probably this comes as close to being an excellent request that fits those particular parameters of any request you'll probably see coming along for asking for lottery funds, because it's a pure capital expenditure and a much needed one in light of what the federal government is requesting us to do. OPB has had strong support in the past from the Oregon legislature, and rightfully so. I think it's one of the great contributions that we make to the state of Oregon, and with a very excellent board, rides very close herd on its operations. Making the improvements both in the South and around the state, I think will get to the digital world and meet the requirements of the federal government. We'll also be in a position to have a technology in place that's going to be good for a long, long time. So I will stop there, and be, if there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Questions for these witnesses. I have one, Bill, if you would. What is, just in real broad terms, your array of funding sources right now?
Thank you for the question, Mr. Chairman. That was the point I forgot to make. I was looking for an entree. The Dallas connection works. we undertook some time ago, probably starting as early as 1995, a private capital campaign to meet this requirement. We have a total capital requirement of around $27 million. We have raised privately over $11 million. That money has come substantially out of the Portland metro area, and Portland benefactors have far more than covered what it would cost to strictly replace that transmission. So in a sense, they have far subsidized other parts of the state. We have emphasized, though we had no promises, we only had hope, to private donors that we would look to the government for a third of our total funding. This portion we're asking for now and some federal funding, but as Representative Westland said, it becomes about a 3-to-1 leverage. Our success, which is substantially both the work of volunteers but also the work of OPB staff, on the private fundraising side is going to be greatly affected by this jump coming from the public portion, because if we can come through and demonstrate that there is the proportional support from the state, we can, I, that will lend a great deal to continuing the private campaign, getting it from the $11 million to the $18 million goal for the private campaign.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, I'm kind of amazed at the range on this sheet of state support for assisting in going over to digital in terms of public broadcasting. For example, it's showing Nebraska with $60 million and other states that are much, much bigger with relatively small amounts. Do any of you have any information on this? And
I do on Nebraska, only because it's come to my attention and I asked the question. Nebraska owns a satellite and serves, I think, to the agricultural community in the Midwest, a broad, through that satellite service, a very broad area, so far beyond the boundaries of the state of Nebraska. So the reason theirs is so high is they have the satellite. We don't have that. We don't use that technology. We rent that technology. We don't own a satellite.
Is that primarily to service rural parts of Alaska and the region or rural regions around the state?
All I know is I know it's agriculturally related, and it has to do with, which would lead me to believe that around Nebraska and many states it would be served.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wood, if I may elaborate on your question, Nebraska is a state network that funds largely or provides service to largely a rural state, as does Alaska. Also, the variation in the amount you see may be dependent on the amount of commitment the states normally make to those organizations for their operational budget. For example, in Nebraska, it's largely funded, I believe, by state funds. They receive some private money as well as some federal money, but a large percentage of their budget is through state funding.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
Historically, what percentage of OPB's budget has been private contributions and support and public support?
It just so happens I have some pie charts here. Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, in 1981-82 fiscal year, state government was supporting OPB to the tune of 42%, and 39% was coming from private support, and 15% was coming from the federal government. In the year 1991-92, it had shifted to 55% private support, and state government had diminished to about 24%. Federal government was still 13%. In the last fiscal year, 1999-2000, state government was only supporting public broadcasting to 10%. That's a figure that's $200,000 less than we were giving in 1981 during the depth of the recession. So what has happened is state has gone down, and as you know, private support through an awful lot of fundraising on the air has gone substantially up and provides a very, very large percentage of the income now for public broadcasting.
Mr. Chair, may I elaborate as well on this question? Representative Witt, the question for Oregon Public Broadcasting is very appropriate. Southern Oregon Public Television, in its 24-year history, has received one state allocation. That was in 1993 when we received $350,000. It is a revolving fund for us. We used it in 1995 and 96 as a means to leveraging private money for our capital campaign at that time. So our normal operating budget is approximately 35% federal dollars and 65% private revenue.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Beck.
While we're on the subject, I appreciate the figures from Tony Van Vliet. If I could get copies of that, I'd appreciate it. I am one person here who has bemoaned the transition this last decade of public broadcasting becoming commercial. Basically, they don't even bother calling themselves commercial free anymore. I just think it is so telling in our society what this means for our whole society, our public broadcasting system. Has advertisements on it regularly now. These fundraising efforts that they have to go through are demeaning in my mind. Both radio and television. I regret the state and the federal government are not funding public broadcasting more. It's a small contribution would go a long distance. And I also think some of the content has been compromised by the reliance on any number of commercial supporters. I don't You'd never get anybody to tell you how, but I'm sure it is. So I'm glad we're providing a little more money to move them into the modern world, but I would encourage the board to make the case in future legislatures to start getting the state to fund public broadcasting. And I'd be curious to get a breakdown of what other states are doing and how many of them are funding public broadcasting, what the rate of various state funding is. I just think it's just, I don't want to say tragic, that would be overstating it, but it's demeaning to see, to me, what's happened to our public broadcasting system. It's not bad, but it's just cheap. And there's no criticism of you folks, you're victims. But I think it's the product of this anti-government era that plagues this whole process here, and you're being affected by it. Speech done.
Any other questions?
I'll make my speech short this week. For rural Oregon especially, the public broadcasting is vital. And we have parts of southern Oregon that does not have cable, and if you can't afford a satellite, you can't get much. And the few stations we get, four or five at the most, and the two radio stations we get out of it, which we call Jefferson Public Radio, not Oregon Public Broadcasting, are actually vital down there. It's one of our best sources of information, and it actually spills over to Northern California, too. We cover a wide area. I think you go out as far as, Lakeview?
No, sir. We get to Klamath Falls.
Klamath Falls. I think yes. Klamath Falls off the coast and up to Roseburg and cover the whole area.
And again, down to La Rica area.
And because of the geography area with Siskiyou Mountain there, we have a huge number of transponders that have to be maintained even for the winter months and ice and snow. So you guys do a great job. We don't want to lose you. This is a small price to pay. And we have no great industrial base to pay for it. So most of the money that comes in is individual donors.
Thank you, Representative Bates, for your words of encouragement. And we pledge to continue to provide quality public television programming.
Pledge we can.
Yeah.
I listen to it every day.
Mr. Chair, I have to tell you, a humorous story-wise on Ways and Means. At that time, Senator Mike Thorne was co-chair of Ways and Means, and I think one of the big spurts into the rural area came when he drove his pickup on top of his farm, and he says, I can't get damn NPR there. Nothing moved faster in the legislature than funding for more transponders to get over in rural Oregon than that particular event. And believe me, it does make a big difference when the co-chair of Ways and Means wants to have something happen in the area of OPB.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, one last favor. I wanted to emphasize something else. Often digital television is confused with high-definition television. They are not synonymous. This technology will not require consumers to go out and acquire very expensive equipment to receive it. There will be a great deal of consumer choice, ranging from no action to very elaborate action. But one thing that was a function of the transmission, while it is being done for economic and technological reasons, we will have a huge capability in television will actually start creeping toward the internet in terms of interactive and the volume of information you can provide a user, and it will become a very legitimate bridge to the digital divide for households that can't afford internet service or high-speed internet service will be able to obtain a great deal of information and educational information from broadcasting. And if time permits, we do have a very brief demonstration of how that will be used. About a 3-minute video?
You bet. Now, I want you to know we saw just a tremendous video on right-of-ways. So the standard has been established. We're going to be expecting great things.
This is sweeps week in the revenue.
Yeah, sweeps week. I don't think there's a lot of sex and violence. Is
Barney free?
Barney free.
All right.
And there's no songs. There's no Barney songs. There's excellent music. This is Jeff Wright, who's helping us. Jeff is part of our private development effort and heads the private side of our capital campaign. To emphasize, this will be an over-the-air service. This is not a computer connection.
I'm sorry, did we get you in the record, please?
Yeah, Bill did introduce
you. We did, okay, right. Thanks. Okay, I was distracted.
And just to emphasize, that quality of production could occur in parallel with three other streams and at a given time. If you forgo high definition, the really cool picture, you now have capacity to have all-day children's programming, all-day adult education, and this kind of programming could all occur concurrently. So you greatly expand the use of broadcasting as an educational tool.
Okay. Any other questions for these gentlemen? Thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you.
Stick around for a second. We'll close the public hearing unless there's anybody else that wants to testify. And open a work session on House Bill 3700. Two things. We have the Dash 1 amendments, which incorporate the Southern Oregon Broadcasting, Public Broadcasting, and then the motion would be to the floor with referral to Ways and Means. Is there a motion? Representative Corey?
Move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3700.
Representative Corey moves the Dash 1 amendments. Base, do you want to make that motion?
I'll let you do it. Sorry.
You want to withdraw your motion? Representative Base.
I'd like to be able to return home to Southern Oregon this weekend without being strung up. So I'd like to move the Dash 1 amendments to the House Bill 3700. Thank you.
All right. Representative Bates moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3700. Is there any discussion? Any objection? No? Therein?
Letting that gavel hang for a while, Mr.
Painful.
Chair.
Representative Bates.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the House Bill 3700 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And
a substantive referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Bates moves House Bill 3700 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation of referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on that motion? Please call the roll.
Representative Bates.
Aye.
Representative Best.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Cass.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye.
Rich.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Excused.
Vice Chair
Boyd.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3700 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation and referral to Ways and Means. Again, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
I would ask the proponents of this if there were any way, when this does come to the floor, if there was a way to have this technology. We probably can't do it on the floor, but if there were a way to do it, with working with the TI, it's just amazing. And yeah, it just depends on timing and how busy we are. But even out in the hallway, to have it available, I think it just is. It would be great for more members to be able to see that. It's just very exciting.
Okay, thank you. See you. Let's go on then to, let me see, where some of these bills are changing even as we speak. House Bill 2730, let's go there. I know we've got some folks in here on that bill. Paul, do you want to come up? Yeah. Whose is that? Is that yours? No.
It's not mine.
Whose is it?
This kid's calling Fogarty.
Ed. Do you have another one? Today?
Yes. 3187.
Really?
I have 3405. You know what I mean?
Mm. Oh, can we do 3187 while Dick's here?
Sure.
I got witnesses on that, too. Let me do that then. Sorry. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3187 and ask Dick to give us the overview on that.
Basically, we're dealing with private activity bonds. You have in Chapter 286, ORS 286, the provisions which set up a private activity bond committee, the purpose being essentially to decide and to allot under the federal limitation private activity bonds that will be essentially subject or eligible for federal income tax exemption. And all this bill does is to add to the list of bonds that are dealt with by the Private Activity Bond Committee would be bonds that deal with waste and recycling collection. You already have in the statutes there on line 12, you have waste management. But this expands that somewhat to include waste itself and recycling. And that's it.
Well, we have Doug Goh. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Mike Dewey and Tamara Townsend. I'll let you decide who goes first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey representing Waste Management. And House Bill 3187 was at the request of Waste Management. And we want to wanted to originally clarify that within the term waste management for the private bond activity program, that waste and recycling collection would be included. As we looked at that further, we recognized that we needed some technical amendments. And when I say technical, they were somewhat complex in the sense of dealing with the federal rules. And you have in your packet describing those amendments, and legislative council unfortunately was unable to bring those to the committee because of the backlog. So we are hopeful that we can schedule a work session when those are available. But what we wanted to do at this point in time is first of all have Mr. Goh describe the bond program and how it works and how a waste management company can fit into that and how it benefits the company, benefits Oregon. And Ms. Townsend would talk about some specific projects that either have been used or are envisioned to be used under the new terminology that clarifies the statute. So with that, I'll have Mr. Goh again.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Doug Goh, let me first touch on what is a private activity bond. As staff indicated, private activity bond is a term used in the federal tax code as the language suggests that benefits a private party. And one of the exemptions under the federal code that qualifies for tax-exempt financing, and of course the whole reason we're here is this allows low interest financing to private companies. And one of the categories eligible under the federal tax law is for solid waste disposal facilities. This is a category that at the county level has been eligible since the early 1970s. And just to give some examples of the sort of projects that qualify, currently you may have seen in the press this weekend, the new dairies that are going out into Morrill County that are going to serve the new Tillamook cheese factory. Tremendous amounts of animal waste are going to be generated by those dairies. Those have to be collected so they don't go into the groundwater stream. And that is an example of a private company, a dairy, receiving and apply and receive the benefit of tax-exempt bonds. In that case, the local port district will be the issuer of those bonds. Another example, another current example is the former Smurfit paper mill in Newburgh is being completely retooled. That will allow it to be able to recycle junk mail and be used to mix in with recycled newspapers. That constitutes the recycling aspect. And I might just note with respect to that project currently qualifies for federal tax level as a solid waste disposal facility. Under state law, they have been able to obtain revenue bond financing from the Economic and Community Development Department as a manufacturing facility, not as a solid waste disposal facility. And one of the reasons that what we address in the amendments is to clarify the existing Economic and Community Development Department statutes to make clear that solid waste disposal facilities, as solid waste disposal facilities such as landfills, transfer stations, and so forth, qualify. Final example, last year, Gillam County issued about $15 million worth of bonds to help the largest employer in Morrill County, which is Waste Management, upgrade its two landfills out there. And that gets me, what is the nature of these bonds? I want to be clear, there are no tax monies involved here. There are no state funds involved backing these bonds. It's purely the credit of the private company that secures the bonds. So there's no lottery funds, no general fund monies, and so forth. It's purely the state, in the case of the Economic and Community Development Department, the counties, in the case of the local issuers, serve as purely a conduit to create the exemption under federal tax law. Let me just touch very briefly on the amendments to the bill that we are seeking. As I mentioned, House Bill 3187 clarifies the Economic and Community Development Department's statutory authority to issue private activity bonds for solid waste disposal facilities. Companies must still compete with other projects and must be approved by the department. The bill also clarifies, as currently written, the scope of what type of bonds may be receive allocations in front of the Private Activity Bond Committee, as the staff indicated. Second, the legislation allows counties to work jointly to issue bonds on behalf of projects. So, for example, Multnomah County could issue revenue bonds, enter into an intergovernmental agreement with Gillum County, with Washington County, with Yamhill County, for different facilities, because you may have these revenue bonds are a very sophisticated financing mechanisms, and if you just have a small amount, you may not have enough amount of projects within a particular county that makes economic sense. So you pool those bonds, and you can issue, a particular county could issue bonds on behalf of several other counties. Again, not using the credit of any of the counties, but of the private company who receives the benefit of the bonds. Finally, the legislation would clarify the existing authority to make clear that a government can be the federal tax owner of solid waste disposal facilities, again, to help facilitate this financing. And the purpose of this amendment is to use a creative idea that's been used in other states and to take advantage, again, of the federal tax code. Federal tax code provides that generally that any type of private activity bond, you have to go and get what's called volume cap. It's a very precious commodity. There's always much greater demand in the state than there is volume cap. If the government owns the solid waste disposal facility, even though it may be subject to a long-term lease to a private company, volume cap is not needed. And so what we are trying to do with this amendment is to avoid the use of the State Private Activity Bond Committee allocation for this purpose, so it can go to low-income housing and to other qualifying projects that need this volume cap. With that, I'll turn it over to Tamara Townsend to discuss some additional qualifying projects.
Please. Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tamara Townsend, representing Waste Management. I just wanted to describe to you how Waste Management has used these types of programs in other states and what they contemplate using this legislation for in Oregon. Waste Management is a company that collects and disposes of solid waste in connection with local governments under franchises, et cetera, and contracts. This bill, for example, would allow Waste Management to, one, compete for volume cap for these private activity bonds. If approved, they would then submit an application to the Oregon Economic Community and Development Department to use these type of bond proceeds to finance improvements to landfills, such as new landfill cell construction, additional vehicles, fleet, machinery, improved liner systems at the landfill, et cetera. Mr. Goh mentioned, this program was used in connection with Gillum County last year to make some improvements to the Arlington landfill. That program created several new jobs for the community, both construction and long-term jobs at the landfill, and was a benefit to the local economy out there. The low-cost financing offers benefits to the company because they're able to reduce their operating costs, which then translates into lower disposal and collection costs for the ultimate consumers. As for the bond finance lease program that Mr. Goh mentioned, Waste Management has used that program in California, Texas, and Ohio. It's an innovative program that they've used to upgrade their fleet. They're part of Waste Management's nationwide program to convert their older diesel vehicles to alternative fuel vehicles, such as liquid natural gas, pretty expensive vehicles, and they're able to use this leasing program as a way to, obtain lower cost financing for the new fleet. They envision trying to do something like that in Oregon, which would bring significant environmental benefits by the decreased air emissions from these alternatively fueled vehicles, and you also have safer trucks and collection vehicles on the road. All of these bonds will be backed by a company guarantee and a a letter of credit issued by a bank. So, thank you if you have any questions.
Questions? Representative Hass.
Thank you. The phrase waste management is already in there. What does that mean? How is that different from what you want to add?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, I think it's just a clarification. Arguably, waste management would include recycling efforts, but we wanted to have that express authority. I think when we apologize that the amendments weren't available to the committee today, I think when you see the other amendments, it'll be a little clearer why we're seeking the amendments. Frankly, to be quite candid with the committee, I think we probably, if just initially looking at that language, we probably could have lived with that language as is. I think it's helpful to have the recycling language, but the other additions to the statute are critical in terms for this sort of project to go forward. That example, I think, is one where I think it's a clarifying technical amendment. As Mr. Dewey indicated, it's probably also something, candidly, that we could probably live with as is.
But the rest of you are saying with the amendments that are coming.
The amendments that are coming are absolutely critical to going forward.
Mr. Chair, if I can just add a little bit that when I was asked to draft this legislation on waste management's behalf, it seemed pretty simple. And then we looked at it, and the bill was introduced, and they looked at some of the programs, and the leaseback, for example, is critical to do the vehicle type of program. And then we just realized there are some other opportunities here with counties coming together because you don't have enough in terms of projects, in terms of bulk, to come together and issue bonds and have one entity do that. And again, it's the credit of the company here or companies, and it's not any general fund or lottery monies that we're talking about here.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Beck.
This to Mike Dewey. Have they done any kind of financial analysis of what they think in Oregon this would save them? Maybe I missed that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beck, I don't have the numbers, and perhaps Ms. Townsend does, but we'll talk about the vehicle. We'll call it an upgrade, if you will, and a more environmentally sound vehicle. They want to move in that direction for a couple of reasons, obviously environment and safety. And these retrofits are fairly expensive. And the question is, would you go ahead and make that investment? There are reasons that you might not. For a while, the stock of waste management was not doing very well, quite candidly. So arguably, you might not make those investments. But now you have an opportunity, if these funds are available, to look at it from the standpoint that it could be a break-even, if you will. And I can't say it's a break-even, but I can tell you that they have an incentive then to make those investments that they might otherwise not make.
Follow up.
Yeah.
So you'd characterize it along those lines more rather than, gosh, if we do this, we're going to save $5 million a year. I mean, is there a memo out there from, I mean, they obviously want to do this to be more profitable. I mean, that's why your business does things. I'm just wondering whether it's just simply it'll allow us to justify making some of these investments or whether there are some hard and fast savings that the company is expecting from this.
You will.
Sure. I'll answer.
I haven't seen any memos.
Well, I'm sure there's one somewhere. Not near
we could
spot.
Provide you with quite a bit of their analysis on what type of financing benefits this brings, and along with that, the incentive to make these types of improvements. For these alternatively fueled vehicles, each one of those vehicles costs about $100,000 to $200,000 per vehicle.
Right.
And so anytime you're able to save on the interest rates for financing, you're incentivized to go forward with the program. States like California have mandated the conversion to those types of vehicles, but Waste does want to convert their fleet nationwide, so they would have this incentive to adopt this type of program in Oregon.
I just might add, Mr. Chair and Representative Beck, in order to make this program work for waste management, it has to be, in terms of dollars, pretty significant, because if you have small projects, the interest rate savings aren't enough for you to make this work. We have had some discussions with the trade group. We brought the bill forward, and we haven't had these discussions, but earlier today I had a discussion with the trade group and about if this bill moves on the Senate side, have a discussion about, and having other parties involved in that discussion, with regard to the smaller waste companies being able to come together and be able to bring a proposal, a project forward, because, again, it's kind of the mass here that makes it worth their while. And so they would come together as partners, a co-op approach. I don't know if that works technically, but that could, for waste management it works. It may also be able to work for smaller companies.
Okay, anything else? All right, thanks very much for the amendments then, and see you back, I guess, when they're ready.
Thank you.
All know when the amendments are up to look at. Okay, thanks very much. Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 3187 before I close the public hearing? All right, then let's open a public hearing. Are you done?
Yes.
Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2730. Is anybody here on 3405? Just in case you're hanging around. That one apparently has some technical problems with the amendments. We've already heard 3405, haven't we?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we did.
We were hearing.
Yeah, so I don't need to open that one. Okay, so anyway, we won't get to 3405 anyway. Ed.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2730 creates an income tax credit for investments in tangible personal property. Credit is calibrated as 10% of qualified investments with a 7-year carry forward period. The amount of credit taken in a tax year, including any amounts carried forward from prior years, cannot exceed 25% of the taxpayer's liability for that tax year. And it would apply to investments placed in service on or after January 1, 2002.
Okay.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul Phillips. I'm here today representing Columbia Sportswear, Intel, Intercare, Louisiana Pacific, Nike, Tektronix, and Sensor Steel. As you know from our previous testimony, and I'm sure there's a bit of fiscal impact fatigue and the variety of things that I've come before you on, but we are dedicated to looking at tax and economic development issues. This is the third part of the trilogy that we brought forward, modeled after the investment tax credit issue of that the federal government had. We have been working aggressively to determine ways that we could make the state more competitive, that we could encourage research and development, and that we could encourage people to purchase equipment and machinery that equates into jobs. This bill particularly is one with the 10% and the 25% cap that we believe would encourage investment in the state of Oregon. We did quite a bit of research last fall and early summer and modeled it after the Qualified Business Investment Tax Program of North Carolina. That qualified tax credit has a $6 million annual cap to a qualified business. It has a number of different ventures in it. When we looked at it, because of its fiscal impact, it probably wouldn't qualify for what we were trying to accomplish in Oregon, but this would be a step in a direction that we thought was positive. As you, Mr. Chair, brought forth tax-related issues for debate, we believe this is certainly one that should be debated. The tangible personal properties aspects that are identified in Section 2 of this bill and defined as property, building, except for agriculture, machinery included outside of a building, are those that we believe that are specifically and directly attached to job creation. There are caps on it, there are fiscal impacts, and I'm sure the Department of Revenue is going to testify about how difficult this is going to be to administer. At least if they didn't, I'd be surprised. I hope they don't, but reality strikes occasionally. 2730 is a new tax credit. Would be new for Oregon, but it's a tax credit that has been used previously. The qualified investment is a policy decision as to how limited or how broad you want to have that. We've crafted in a fairly narrow aspect, but it could be narrower. The limitations of 10% and 25% overall were modeled after other states. Again, those are things that can be crafted specifically for Oregon based on the fiscal impact. However, clearly we believe the record shows that this would encourage investment in our state. With that, Mr. Chair, I want to then bring to your attention something that Representative Witt discussed with us, and it's the amendments that we passed out, -1 amendments 2730, and we passed out the smart growth of the Nike testimony. Most of this investment, from what we can tell from other states, the larger companies here in Oregon probably wouldn't benefit from. However, the smaller startup firms would benefit directly from. Representative Witt raised the issue of how can we diversify statewide and do some things to encourage investment in other parts of the state, thus the -1 amendments. The -1 amendments really set this qualified investment program and scale up the caps based on the unemployment in the particular area. So obviously if you were in Grant County, the highest unemployment rate, and you were able to invest in equipment and machinery, and that it was directly related to this qualified investment, your credit would be higher. Again, these are suggestions that we put forth from a policy discussion. The more investment in equipment and machinery that individuals have, it's directly tied to jobs. Somebody has to run those equipment. So while we have R&D and we have some other things that might be arguably beneficial to more populous areas, we tried to look at what would be best for the state's economy in some of the rural areas where have higher unemployment. These are our suggestions on how you might want to look at it. There's nothing locked in stone here, but it was obviously from discussions we've had with members, including Representative Witt, it was trying to come up with a creative idea on a way to incentivize investment in rural Oregon, particularly in some areas that aren't so rural but have high unemployment rates that might not be in enterprise zones, that might not have some other elements there to it. That was the reason that the -1 amendments are drafted up. I think from a policy discussion of how tax policy and economic development work together, at some point Oregon is going to have to look at all the tax credits and see which ones generate jobs, which ones encourage investment, and which ones move forward. This was our best suggestion as to what the legislature ought to look at, Mr. Chair, and with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions? Representative Pofori.
Thank you. Paul, you said that some of the larger companies would not benefit or necessarily benefit from this legislation. Can you explain that?
And that's strictly based on what's happened in other states and when the federal government had the 10% ITC, most of these programs are targeted, like the one in North Carolina, are targeted towards emerging businesses, small businesses. They have used the federal small business research programs to judge on who qualifies for it. So they very narrowly targeted towards more of the small companies. Those that purchase equipment to start up and need these credits are manufacturing facilities. Usually tend to be the smaller employers that are looking for capital, as this helps you defer capital costs. Capital investment is what stalls most development and most investment in small businesses, and in fact is why a lot of small businesses fail. So this is one way to help mitigate the cost of capital.
Yes.
So would Nike, for example, be able to use this tax credit if should we implement it?
Well, I think you see Mr. Peterson's and Mr. Kelly's language here. It would certainly be available to them as it would be to any other business, but in truth, it would probably be more advantageous to a smaller startup or a business coming to Oregon versus somebody that already has more than 1 million square feet of property developed and their programs underway. That's not to say they couldn't take advantage of it, but it'd be pretty narrow.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Paul, as I recall, when this provision was available in the federal tax code, it had the impact of making it more affordable and creating an incentive for businesses to buy, to invest in more productive equipment. And thus, with that more productive equipment, drive up wages, drive up output, drive up economic growth and activity. That's what you have in mind here, I think, primarily, isn't it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Witt, that's exactly. The more well-stated, and if I didn't say it clearly, you certainly did. But it's illogical. If you can't afford capital investment and you can't afford modern or newer equipment, your ability to expand jobs and expand your marketplace are limited, too. So it truly is an effect, an economic stimulus. The more you can invest in capital, the more employees you can have, the broader marketing you can engage.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I can tell you from my own business back in the early, mid-80s when this was in effect at the federal level, as you would be coming to the end of a calendar year where many small businesses would have their fiscal year, your sales would shoot through the roof because a lot of companies would buy equipment at the end of the year in order to get the benefit of the ITC for that year's taxes. Mm-hmm. And this would be the type of equipment that would increase their productivity. So, you know, there's an economic impact to this kind of a provision, not only from the standpoint of greater productivity in terms of output, but also from stimulating a lot of sales of hardware and equipment that's designed to make businesses more productive. Do we have a revenue impact on this?
No, I was just asking it.
Representative Witt, I haven't had a chance to run the numbers yet.
Mr. Chairman, what we might want to do is we might want to take this basic bill and run through a few different scenarios. You know, limiting this to a certain extent to smaller business or newer business. Secondly, capping the amount of the credit. Right now it's at 25% of taxpayer liability, but maybe capping it also by a dollar amount so that most of the benefit will flow to small business. Maybe we can look at a few different scenarios to this and then look at the revenue impact from those different scenarios.
If you want to work with that, that'd be...
Yeah, if that's okay, that's what I'll do, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, having learned from the two previous bills how you can get asked questions on these type of things that are difficult at times to defend, I'll ask the questions now. Maybe you can supply the answers so when I face the caucus we can deal with them. Do other states have this? Why do the feds drop the program? Do we have any solid evidence that it does increase jobs and increase wages? That it does what we hope it would do?
Okay.
What about North Carolina?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, all good questions. Yes, other states do have it, and in fact, North Carolina was the one that I targeted the 10% and the 25% language off of. The second question, I believe, was the federal one, if I recall, and I'll have to research that up. I could make up a good answer, but I actually don't have one.
Mr. Chairman, I know a little bit about that. The ITC departed the federal tax code in 1986 when Senator Packwood largely rewrote the tax code. And at that time, if you recall, we were significantly reducing rates and simplifying rates, and there were a lot of things in the code that got thrown out at that point in time. I can't tell Representative Bates that in my particular industry, the ITC had a very, very positive impact in terms of stimulating sales of productive equipment.
And Mr. Chair, Representative, to the third question about the response and generation capacity of this, what we did is look at a map of Oregon and the number of manufacturing facilities that have closed up over the last 10 years and the change in the economic structure and the types of wages that were generated by those jobs. Impact is significant. You can see, and I think you guys gave at the beginning of the session the same kind of fiscal impacts of the changes that have occurred around Oregon. If I remember, it was this committee that saw those. It is clear that the fewer the manufacturing jobs, the lower the wages, the more seasonal employment. So there is an economic theory that I'm sure Paul and I could get in a great debate over what has to do with the amount of equipment and machinery purchased, the amount of manufacturing jobs, and the stability of the economy. So it's clearly, from a response generator, this is the type of investment that you, from an economic development strategy, try and go after. And when, at one point, I was worked in economic development in Washington County, the TVDC side of it when it first started up. We prioritized, for specific reasons, manufacturing facilities and equipment purchases. that we found, going back to what Representative Kefauver asked, that the capital-intensive marketplace was clearly the most stable, but it was also the most difficult to get into because of access to capital. So if there were ways to open up the door to capital investment, the economy was benefited over the long term. So in a roundabout way, when we looked at, when we came up with three concepts before you the last year, we looked at ways that would hit each segment of the economy. And this one, trying to get the manufacturing facilities, and both small and large, reinvesting in Oregon, was one that would have the best long-term return for the state. So that, and that's based on what other states were doing.
Okay. Representative Beck.
I'd be curious to explore, and the amendments kind of get at it, but I'd be really curious to see the numbers on targeting this toward rural communities, where we clearly have a need in the state. And, you know, if we can't, if the fiscal on the bulk of the bill and the bulk of the likely investment is going to be too high, maybe targeting this to rural communities with high unemployment rates would be a good way to pilot this and see if it does anything.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, I would concur with you. In fact, other states used a total of $50,000 for a tax credit, and they had specific caps on it. So those are policy discussions that you guys can engage in and make a determination of how broad or how narrow you want to do this, what regions of the state. You can even pick what, and specifically say for manufacturing. I think we still have the ability to, from coding it, and which entity, which types of businesses you want to have it available to. That's a policy debate for you guys to engage in, but this is clearly one of the ones that we believe would be best in the long term from an investment strategy for the state.
Mr. Chair, how much, maybe Representative Witt knows this, where does the Economic Development Department get involved in these types of bills? And we never see them in here on our tax credit bills that are...
They had a letter in the file on the...
the sales tax register. They were in on that. I'd be curious to see if they have thoughts. You know, we're about to spend all this lottery money on rural infrastructure. Okay, what are we doing to make it really work by, you know, bolstering that investment with this type of incentive? And whether the department is thinking about, they may not even be aware of this bill, that's fine, but I'd be curious to get their insights into how to better utilize the investments, the other investments we're going to make in rural communities.
All right, in closing, Mr. Chair and Representative, we need an integrated economic development strategy for the entire state,
yeah.
And the governor's articulated what his views are. I'd encourage you to ask the agency to come in and lay out, because there are some good things going on, and Doris Penwell, and there's folks there that could go through some of the programs that are there, and we could always do more.
Well, we'll see what develops in discussions about this then, and go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Thank you, Paul. Anybody else wish to testify on the bill? If not, I'll close the public hearing. What are you doing here?
Representative Nelson.
You're visiting. Well, I wish we had more to entertain you with, but we are to the end of our agenda, and so we are adjourned.
What are all you people doing?
Oh. Yeah.